All right. Thank you, Dove, and everyone. Nice seeing you again. It's always nice being back home in Pal Talk after being away. This weekend I was in Quincy, Massachusetts at the home of Vicky Poppy, and I think it was between 25 and 30 people that came. I don't really recall, something like that. And, of course, you know, I talked all day, and I don't remember a lot of what I said. I'm sure it was just more of the same old stuff that I say all the time when I teach. But there was one thing that stuck in my mind. It was kind of funny. It kind of stuck in my mind. There were a lot of questions, both in the morning and the afternoon. We kept circling back around to it. There were a lot of questions about guidance. And it was said more than a few times, people, you know, listening, you know, basically said that they didn't feel like they heard guidance like I do. And they understood that was an error. You know, they didn't want to put me on a pedestal or say that I had some special listening ability they didn't have. They understood that that was an error. So they were looking for help. But they wanted to know, you know, how they could recognize their guidance. I would say as easily as I recognize mine. I'd say that was kind of the theme. And then, lo and behold, when I turned on the computer for the first time this morning, the very first email I opened was a similar in its flavor. You know, someone wanting to recognize guidance. So that's what led to this morning. I made a decision. I thought, you know, maybe I just need to demonstrate guidance by really giving people very specific examples of how guidance shows up in my day. You know, very specific examples, because it's really hard to explain to someone that intuitive feeling of guidance. You know, you can't really describe it. It's too subtle to be described. So I thought maybe if I just tell stories, because I do experience guidance all through the day, all through the day. And maybe if I just, you know, tell little stories about here's something that happened today and here's what the guidance felt like by drawing a picture through stories, maybe people will begin to recognize, oh, I hear guidance. They might even, honestly, in a lot of cases, recognize I hear it and I ignore it. You know, that they might recognize that, but that's okay because then they can start changing their mind about that. But like the story I told this morning, I'm pasting these stories to my Facebook, to the Open Minds Facebook page, but I also decided to go ahead and post them to NTI Discussion Group, NTI Study Group, and the Peace of God. So those are the five places where I'll be putting them if you just kind of want to keep your eyes open for them. But the story I told today was the story of on Sunday I was in Massachusetts at my boyfriend's house, and it was raining outside, so we weren't really doing anything, and I was just goofing off with the iPad. And since we're going to Israel soon, I was just kind of looking at information about Israel to see if there was anything I could learn, you know, that I might share while I'm there, you know, some little interesting tidbit or something, share with the people who go with me. And I came across this website called JesusTrail.com that was incredibly exciting to me. I mean, very exciting. My heart just really started beating with excitement. And it's about a walking trail. It takes on average 4 days to walk it from Nazareth to Capernaum. And there is a scripture in the Bible somewhere in Matthew near the beginning. I don't know the scripture right off the top of my head, but there is a scripture in the Bible that says something about Jesus walked from Nazareth to Capernaum. You know, it says that he made that walk. And of course, nobody knows exactly where his footsteps land, but somebody has created a trail that they feel most likely would be the trail that Jesus walked, because it goes through, it's a fairly direct line, but it also goes through villages where he may have been able to stop for food, water, a place to sleep, right? And they call it the Jesus Trail. And I could just really feel that I want to walk this Jesus trail. I mean, it was so exciting to me. And I knew instantly that Danielle would want to walk it with me because I know her. But what I told people in the post this morning is I don't perceive that as guidance. I perceive that, if I was to put a name on it, I'd say that's the script, or that's just what unfolded on Sunday. You know, I was goofing off. I came around across this website and my heart started beating. I felt real excitement about it. You know, that's what happened. the guidance was more an interpretation of that event. The guidance that I do feel right now around that is not really to do a lot with that, at least not now. It's more of a feeling of weight. I feel like I have, you could call it permission or guidance to go ahead and look into it, to go ahead and, you know, learn more about it. I've ordered the guidebook. But other than that, I just feel this weight. I don't feel a yes, you know, do it. And I don't feel a no, don't do it. I feel a weight. And I said, that's what I would call the guidance. And I think maybe sometimes people confuse the heart beating, the I want to do this, they think that's the guidance, and maybe they also feel the weight, but they disregard the weight because of the heart beating. The heart beating is louder, the heart beating is more exciting, the weight is very subtle. And in fact, I find most guidance is very subtle, and I'm sure that's why they call it the still, quiet voice. You know, and guidance does guide me all through the day. It guides me on what to say, on what not to say, on when to listen to someone, when to turn my attention away from something because it's just not where my attention needs to be. You know, it does all of that all the time, and it's a very, very subtle feeling. And what's happened is I have just tuned into that very subtle feeling so that I can follow, you could say, those directions. But the ego is often much louder. The script, maybe we don't even want to call it ego, maybe the script is much louder, I don't know, whatever that heart beating was, that excitement that I want to was very loud. And I may do it someday, I don't know. But also, another guidance I have is just to be okay with whatever happens. Not even though the heart beating is there, I don't need to deny the heart beating. I don't need to deny the how exciting this idea is for me. But there is an ability to recognize that excitement and still truly follow the guidance, which is not to be attached. To know that, you know, whatever the guidance does end up guiding is what's in my best interest and everyone's best interest. So whether I go or not go, that's the best. And obviously, you know, if we make up a scenario, I wouldn't want to get so excited by this heart beating that I... Dove, I'm going to come back to that comment in a second. I wouldn't want to get so excited by this heart beating that I force against guidance and go on this trip, even though guidance is saying no, and maybe even guidance is putting up roadblocks to try and slow me down, go on this trip and then, you know, get injured or, you know, be there during a war or, you know, or just not be where it would be better for me to be at the time. I obviously don't want that. So it's not difficult for me to understand that guidance is always in my/our best interest. And it's not difficult for me to understand that even though I really would love to do this, if guidance says no, I actually want that more. I want that more than I want to force my hand. So yeah, the guidance was the weight. And Dove, I notice you're saying you walked the Jesus trail. Do you want to take the mic for a second and talk about that? Here, I'm going to let go of the mic and see if you want to talk about that comment.
Well, I did go to this site when you posted it, I think, yesterday, and I did take a real look at it. And you know, talking about deja vu, yes, I walked it. Possibly not in this lifetime, of course. I have not been to Israel in this lifetime, as you know. But I have walked it. And I think we've all walked it. And yes, we go back and we walk it again. I want to thank you for your sharing on guidance. Very, very helpful. Thank you so much, Regina.
Sure, and I'm just going to continue to share on guidance as prompted. Like I said, just little stories like that one. That kind of demonstrate what happened in my day, what was, you know, you could say before me and what the guidance said. And I think it's possible that by sharing these stories, they're like pictures in the book, that people that aren't quite clear on guidance, it might help them to tune in a little more, to be a little more clear, because I do know that we all get guidance all through the day, just like Lesson 49 says. And it would be wonderful to help people get in touch with that. All right, so that's the end of my story about Boston. That was kind of the big outcome from that trip. So we're here now for the seven steps to awakening, and we're going to begin at number 162, which is in the book at the very top of page 40. But before we begin the seven steps to awakening, what I would like to do is just pause, you know, and take a moment of silence. We could call it a moment of tune in. So if y'all would join me in that, I would appreciate it. Amen. All right, so I'm going to give you a link. This is a link to my personal journal, and it's a link to number 162, because that's where we will be starting. If you're listening on the radio, the address for my journal is RDA7, and that is the digit 7. It is not spelled out. rda7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. Again, that's rda7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. And when you get to the journal, you'll see a little menu bar at the top with a step 1 and a step 2 on it. Click on step 1 and then find the number category that will allow you to find your way to number 162. Because we will begin at number 162. Now, as always, what I'm going to do is read from the book first, so that will be different than what's in the journal. The journal is what I wrote after contemplating quote number 162 in the book. And the quotes in the book right now are still coming from a book called The Supreme Yoga. And this is what number 162 says. Abandoning all limited concepts, abandoning even the division between the worshiper and the worshipped. Worship the self by the self. Be at peace, pure, free from cravings. And I did talk about that a little bit in Quincy this weekend. We talked about, someone asked a question about guides, how I felt about inner guides. And I said that, of course, I had experience with inner guides. You know, I had the experience with the inner guide that we call the Holy Spirit, which, of course, is where NTI came from. And then I had the experience of the inner guide, which is called Ramana Maharshi, which is where the teachings of the Inner Ramana came from. But I also talked about how the last thing that Ramana taught me were the three states of mind. And some of you may remember these three states of mind. He described a state of mind called resistor, doubter, and abiding. And he said that resistor is, you know, the average person in the world today. It's the person who really thinks they know who they are. They truly believe they're this personality, this body, this lifetime history. They don't really doubt that at all. But what's happening is, in believing that, they're fully resisting the truth of who they are. So that state of mind is called the resistor. The doubter is actually moving in the direction of awakening. The doubter is now becoming aware of thoughts that clearly point to awakening. These thoughts could be in a book, like A Course in Miracles or NTI or The Seven Steps to Awakening. These could come from an inner guide, like Jesus or Ramana Maharshi. These could come from an outward teacher, you know, like a Muji and Adyashanti and Eckhart Tolle. But basically, in some form or another, the person is becoming aware of thoughts that point to truth. And there's something in the person that recognizes the truth of these thoughts or these statements. But the person still identifies with being the student. And they believe the teacher is an other, whether it's a, you know, another person, a book, or whether it's an inner guide. You know, there seems to be an other there. And you ask questions of the other and you learn from the other. That's the doubter, because you're recognizing who you are. You're recognizing thoughts that point to truth, but you're still doubting that that wisdom is yourself. You think it comes from an other. And Ramana told me that I had had a wonderful doubter phase, which I had. You know, plenty of questioning of inner guides and receiving answers and getting clarity. So I'd had a wonderful doubting phase. But I was told that if all of this knowledge could be received in that way, in the appearance of receiving it from an other within, that actually that learning no longer needed to occur, that the knowledge was actually conscious enough that I could just be that. And moving into being that is abiding. That's how this was explained. Being that is abiding. So, so, and after that, my experience with an inner guide with Ramana began to dissolve and then, of course, disappear, because you can't have an inner guide, an other that you learn from, and be in abiding as well. You know, you can't have both. So if we look back at 162, the quote from the Supreme Yoga after hearing that story, notice what it says. Abandoning all limited concepts, abandoning even the division between the worshiper and the worshipped. You see how the other there falls away. Abandoning even the division between the worshiper and the worshipped. Worship the self by the self. Be at peace, pure, free from cravings. So what's interesting about this particular quote is that even though this is the same guidance, it's really guiding to move away from the belief in an other into just the being of it. This does not drop the devotion. That's kind of interesting. Some people might imagine that if you are moving into the abiding, moving into the being, that the devotion somehow falls away. But that's not the case here. And in fact, in NTI, I don't know if I can quickly find it. I'll try, and if I can't, we'll give it up. It's in NTI Revelation. There's what NTI describes as a description of heaven. Let's see if I can find it really quick. Okay, here we go. I did. So there's a little song here that's being sung by what are called the four eternal creatures. And the song is, "Holy, holy, holy are you, the Father and the Christ, who was and is to come, for always and eternally. Amen." And then it says, "With the same eternal sight and with joy and gratitude in its heart." Maybe this isn't quite what I was looking for, because this still seems to have a separation in it. "The creation of the Father echoes its honor in glory to the Father forever. Amen." And then it says, this is the line that I was really looking for. It says, "This is a description of heaven. This is a description of the recycling of joy and love." And when I heard that word, recycling of joy and love, the feeling that I got, even though the words here still spoke of a father and a son, the feeling that I got of the scribe was more of a movement of devotion, or a movement of gratitude, or a movement of love within oneself. Just a movement within. And so I think it was really more that I was feeling when I wrote it, more than the words itself that I was after. And that's what this reminds me of again, the Supreme Yoga, when it says, abandoning all limited concepts, abandoning even the division between the worshiper and the worshipped, which means abandoning even the idea of father and son, creator and created, right? which is often the last step that many people take in the letting go of the ideas of duality, right? Abandoning even the division between the worshiper and the worshipped. Worship the self by the self. Be at peace, pure, free from cravings. All right, let's look at 162 in the journal and have a look at what I wrote after contemplation of this. Be devotion itself, not devoted to, not devoted for, devotion itself. For me, this captures what this is talking about. You know, instead of being devoted to the Father or being devoted to Ramana or being devoted to A Course in Miracles, or instead of being devoted for the reward of grace or being devoted for the reward of feeling an open heart chakra or being devoted for any other reward, you know, just be devotion itself. Just be that. Be devotion. There's no duality in that. There's no other in that. There's no idea of lack and needing to receive something in that. Right? So be devotion itself. Not devoted to, not devoted for. Devotion itself. All right, so that's 162. So what I will do now is scroll down, and you all can scroll down with me if you're in the journal. On the left, just underneath the little leave a reply box, you'll see where there's a blue 163. If you click on that, that will take you to the next journal entry. And several people have joined us in the room, so I'm going to copy that link and paste it in the room. And then those of you who want to go into the journal and read along with us, you can just click in that link, and that will take us to the next one we're going to read. However, before I read from the journal number 163, I'm going to read from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, number 163, so we can see what I was contemplating when I wrote in my journal. Number 163. Conditioning is sorrow. But conditioning is based on thoughts and notions. However, the truth is beyond such experience, and the world is an appearance like a mirage. Again, this quote originally comes from a book called The Supreme Yoga, and I will read the quote again, and then we will go look at the journal. Conditioning is sorrow, but conditioning is based on thoughts and notions. However, the truth is beyond such experience, and the world is an appearance like a mirage. It's kind of like, I feel like he's kind of, you know, in his own way saying, you know, but all that stuff's hogwash. But that's hogwash, you know. So if all of that is hogwash, then sorrow is hogwash too, you know. But let's go look at the journal, number 163. And this is what I wrote after contemplation. Or actually, sometimes the writing is actually during contemplation. The contemplation is being put down on paper. There is really only one thing that needs to be remembered. It is not real. That thought is not real. That opinion of how it needs to be is not real. That emotion is not real. That which I look on with these eyes is not real. That which I hear with these ears is not real. Anything that comes and goes, shifts and changes, is not real. Am I giving meaning precedent as if it is real? Can I see that this meaning precedent I am giving is mistaken and the root cause of suffering? Am I willing to let go of this meaning precedent that I have given? All right, we might be here just a little bit. This is, a wonderful self-teaching. Self-teaching self. First of all, one thing I've noticed about the journal, just like everything else I've ever written, it's like a course is being put down here. So again, I'm writing my own course. There was a course, of course, in NTI, a course in the messages that came to Regina and Laurent, which ended up going with Laurent primarily as his course. And then the teachings of Inner Ramana, the single quiet thoughts called the thoughts of awakening. These all seem to be like a course, the way they developed. And I'm noticing the same thing with this journal. There's a course here. And this course is asking me to practice it. And this course seems to put forth three primary practices. And this is really the first teaching of one of those three practices. The three primary practices that I'm seeing put forth in the journal are investigation, which could also be called inquiry or questioning, an investigative mind. The second one is the contemplation itself, which is clearly the main practice that's writing the course anyway, you know, the contemplating of these thoughts. And the third one is called remembrance. Remembrance. And remembrance is, although it sounds very mental, remembrance is actually not mental, at least not the way I experience it. Remembrance is heart being brought into the mental to kind of break up or interrupt what the mental was about to do. In fact, a post I think I made yesterday or the day before had the image of a pinwheel. If you think of the ego's cause and effect cycle as a pinwheel, then investigation, contemplation, and remembrance, I said, were like taking a finger and poking it into that pinwheel to slow it down. And eventually that poking finger stops that pinwheel completely, and then there's only really stillness light. So remembrance is a part of that three-legged stool. Some of you in training may know about the three-legged stool. Any good teaching has a three-legged stool, three parts to hold it up. And the three-legged stool in this teaching seems to be the investigation, the contemplation, and the remembrance. So remembrance is a part of that three-legged stool that appears to have been designed to slow down and then stop the ego cycle completely. And remembrance is, again, it's a heart remembering. It's not mental. So, you know, if I was to make up an example, and this is a totally made-up example, but let's say that, you know, Jasmine is, you know, acting like a 15-year-old in some way, and my mind, the ego, is for a moment listening to her and thinking, you know, that she's not respecting me or thinking she's going to get herself in trouble and therefore becoming fearful, or something's beginning to happen in the mind. The heart remembrance pops up and reminds me the outer form is not real. And it reminds me in a very real way. Again, it's not just intellectual. The outer form is not real. And what that does for me then is it tunes my attention away from the outer form back to what we'll call the inner guidance. And now instead of being tuned into that outer form and what was about to play out there, I'm back within remembering, okay, this is not real. And now with that realization, you know, what is my part? And my guidance comes, which could be anything in the story I'm making up. The guidance is just to not worry. You know, just to not worry. Just say, okay, I hear what you're saying. And then not worry. You know, maybe that's the guidance. So the remembrance is literally remembering from the heart, not an intellectual remembering, that whatever appears to be very real in my life, whatever appears to be my current trauma, my current problem, it's not real. Now, I'm going to go ahead and tell you guys a story of something that happened to me yesterday. Yesterday, I was on a plane flying back from Massachusetts, and I was on an aisle seat, and I was actually involved in contemplating the seven steps. So I had my head down, and I was deep in contemplation. And I was actually looking at thoughts about the body is not real. I was actually looking at the realization that the body is only experienced through thought. That's what was actively going on. And I was looking very deeply at that, that you cannot experience a body except through thought. And without knowing what was going on, I felt something. That was my first experience. I felt something. So I looked up, and as I looked up, I saw a suitcase falling off of my head onto the floor, and there was a woman also falling to the floor, and men kind of reaching for her, trying to stop all this from happening. And I realized what had happened. She was getting on the plane, and she had been putting her bag in the overhead bin above me, and somehow she must have lost her balance, and she fell, and the bag fell. And my first thought when I understood the situation, my first thought was for her. My first thought was, oh, are you okay? And so attention immediately went to her. And, you know, through her response and her getting up, you know, I was able to tell she was okay. She was just very embarrassed. You know, she said something like, oh, that's quite an entry, you know, or something like that. And you know, one of the men, you know, put her bag up above, and they went on, you know, and all this happened in, you know, pretty quickly. A few seconds, but they went on. And then as they walked away, the thought hit my mind. It wasn't really a word thought, but I have to obviously put it in words to tell you. But the thought hit my mind that I had been hit directly in the head from above by a very heavy bag, and I was hurt. And as soon as that thought hit my mind, I felt a pain in my neck and in the top part of my, I guess you call it the vertebrae, the top part of my back, my spine. I don't know what you call it. But then there was this noticing. Of course, remember, I had been contemplating that you cannot experience the body except through thought. So there was this quick noticing that I did not feel an injury before the thought. Right? I did not feel the injury before the thought. And so there was this quick noticing, this can't be real. And I actually said no. I mean, just like I was talking to a child, I said no to that thought. I said, no, you're not going to pull that on me. I know this isn't real, you know. And the thought retreated, and so did the pain. So, of course, I'm not injured. But as I looked at that later, I thought, you know, if I had not been in contemplation when this happened, let's imagine I was looking around and watching what was going on around me, and I was watching the woman put the bag up above me, and then I saw it begin to fall. Isn't it possible that there would have been a quick decision before the bag even hit me that I'm going to be hurt? And then as soon as the bag hit, I would have experienced an injury, right? Because in that case, there would have been no realization that it's not real. There only would have been the thought, you know, because the eyes were seeing it, because of the five senses, because the eyes were seeing it and the mind was active in what was seen and interpreting very quickly. There only would have been the thought, this is real and I'm going to be hurt. And then there would have been hurt. I know there could have been, because when the thought crossed my mind in the way it did happen, there was pain during the time that the thought was allowed. So I know that if the belief had been there that I was going to be injured, I would have been injured. I have enough evidence to say that's the case. Now, hold on. I'm going to let Jamie out. So my point is, you know, that this remembrance that it's not real can actually have effects, I guess, for lack of better words. It can actually have effects. You know, so if I am able to say that thought is not real, here's a very early realization I had on this path. Back in the first year when I was a student of A Course in Miracles, there was this girl at work that I hated. And every time I saw her, like, the very first thought was, I hate her. And you know, it was always dread seeing her. Oh no, here she comes again. You know, all these feelings around this. But one day, when that thought appeared she was walking towards me. I still remember right where I was and right where she was. I saw her walking towards me, and the thought was, oh, God, I hate her. And then something in me said, that's just a thought. You know, what if that's just nothing? What if that's nothing? And I literally made a decision in that moment not to believe that I hate her. And that experience that I'd had for years, I'd known this woman for years, it literally vanished and I never had it again. And in fact, to some degree, we never became best friends, but to some degree we became friends. So you know, this idea that things aren't real, again, it's not just an intellectual idea. First of all, it's a truth. But secondly, when there's some kind of a heartfelt knowing behind it, it actually can change things. You know, the thought that I hate someone disappears and the emotion of the hating goes away. If my opinion of something disappears because I realize this opinion is not real. If I believe my opinion about the economy is real, then I watch the news and you know, they're saying stuff that triggers my opinion. I get all upset because this is my opinion about the economy and what should be done and what's not being done right. Now I'm upset, right? But if I realize that my opinion is not real, it's not real, then I can watch the exact same news and there's no upset. And emotion. You know, the big one that I learned with emotion is guilt. You know, A Course in Miracles teaches us that we are not guilty. But I'll tell you what, that emotion of guilt teaches us that we are. If you've ever felt guilt, and I'm sure you probably have, you know exactly what I'm talking about. When you are feeling that emotion, it feels like a factual statement about you. You are guilty. But there came a point for me where I saw that that emotion itself is just an effect. It's just a belief, you know, but it's not a real statement about who I am. I can actually feel guilt. I don't remember feeling guilt in a while, but I could get to the point where I could feel guilt and not simultaneously believe that I was guilty, because I ceased believing that the emotional feeling was a fact about me. So this idea, this remembrance that this is not real, it's not just an intellectual statement. It's certainly not meant for denial. And I know it's been used that way, to not look at how I feel, right? It's not meant that way. And when it comes from the heart, it doesn't happen that way. When it comes from the heart, there's enough separating of belief, or enough separating of attachment, or enough separating of fear from what appears to be happening, that there's a release of some type. So again, there is really only one thing that needs to be remembered. It is not real. That thought is not real. That opinion of how it needs to be is not real. When you can really look at, quote, what seem to be your own opinions and say, you know what, that is not real. That is not what I really think. And you can step back from your own opinions. I really think you're getting somewhere. And you're moving into peace. That opinion of how it needs to be is not real. That emotion is not real. That which I look on with these eyes is not real. That which I hear with these ears is not real. Anything that comes and goes, shifts and changes, is not real. And then look at the, now this is the investigation part of the three-legged stool. Look at the self-investigation that's happening here. Am I giving meaning precedent as if it is real? Now let's look at my story about the bag hitting me on the head yesterday. What if, as soon as that thought occurred that I'd been hurt, what if I gave that meaning precedent as if it was real? I might still be having a neck ache today, you know? So the question is, am I giving meaning precedent as if it was real? I did with this lady at work for a time, right? When the thought showed up that said I hated her, I gave it meaning precedent as if it was real, and I experienced those effects. I've had opinions, you know, of how things should be, and I gave them meaning precedent as if they mattered, as if they were real, and then I would experience upset when things were not that way. So this is the investigation part. It's just, it's looking back at me, at my mind, at what I do, and asking, am I giving meaning precedent to any of these not real things in my experience as if they're real? Right? And then, if I say yes, and most of us, at least in some cases, will, then the next question is, okay, so there I am giving meaning precedent, right? I think my daughter should behave a certain way, for example. Then, can I see that this meaning precedent I am giving is mistaken and the root cause of suffering? Can I see a connection between my lack of peace and this meaning precedent that I'm giving that opinion? And taking time to really look at that. And in fact, I'll let you look while I let Jamie in. Just another silly little example here in Pueblo West, at least. I don't know if it's true for you, Lynn, in Pueblo. But in Pueblo West, we have a moth season. I don't know where they come from. I don't know anything about moths. But suddenly there are lots and lots of moths. And what happens at night, and I have no idea how they get in, even if you keep all the doors closed and everything, somehow they manage to come in, and they come in by the dozens. And they stay in the house all night, and then at some point in the morning, most of them seem to disappear. A few get kind of stuck inside, but most of them seem to disappear back outside again. Well, I don't have a thought that it should be different. But Jasmine, and at least Jasmine, I think maybe Danielle, and definitely Jasmine, because she expresses her opinion, has a thought that it should be. So every time she sees a moth in the house, there's like a bit of suffering, you know? In her mind, it shouldn't be happening. So see, she gave meaning precedent to the idea that there shouldn't be moths in the house. I did not give meaning precedent to the idea that there shouldn't be moths in the house. She suffers, I don't. You see how this works? So can I see that the meaning precedent I am giving to my thought or opinion or emotion or what I see or what I hear is not real? Again, one primary reason that the bag did not hurt me is because I did not see it fall. My mind did not have the opportunity prior to the bag hitting me to make the decision, this is going to hurt, I'm going to be injured. That it didn't have the opportunity. You see, what we see, what we hear, you know, the mind interprets that data. And if we give the mind's interpretation meaning precedent, then we suffer. Now, after asking the second question, can I see that this meaning precedent I am giving is mistaken and the root cause of suffering, comes the third question in this investigation. Am I willing to let go of this meaning precedent I have given? You could say that's kind of what quickly happened for me yesterday when the thought did come, I'm hurt. There was pain. But then I said, no, 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 no. I mean, I knew this didn't have to be that way. I knew it. And I stood up in that. No, I'm not buying this. And it all went away. So in that case, I was fully willing to let go of the meaning precedent that I gave for a second. I had to have given it for a second, or I wouldn't have felt the pain. And this is a really important question, I think. Because I do think that sometimes we aren't willing to let go of the meaning precedent we're given. I want to continue to believe, no, he's wrong. I'm right. I want to continue to believe, no, this is the way things need to be. I want to continue to believe, no, she should behave this way. I want to continue to believe, no, they shouldn't have said that, right? And so because I'm not willing to let go of the meaning precedent I have given, the suffering continues. So like I said, I think This number 163, I think, is a good one. And, you know, we have an hour and a half here, and we're obviously going to go look at more. But there's a part of me that would be very satisfied if we just stopped here and if everybody printed this and went off and just spent time with this. Because a lot of clarity and release could come through just this one journal entry. There is really only one thing that needs to be remembered. It is not real. That thought is not real. That opinion of how it needs to be is not real. That emotion is not real. That which I look on with these eyes is not real. That which I hear with these ears is not real. Anything that comes and goes, shifts and changes, is not real. Am I giving meaning precedent as if it is real? Can I see that this meaning precedent I am giving is mistaken and the root cause of suffering? Am I willing to let go of this meaning precedent that I have given? All right, we'll go on now. So let's scroll down, and again, on the left side, right underneath the leave a reply box, you will see number 164. You can click on that. And for those of you that are new to the room, I will give you a link. All right, I'm just going to take a little drink of water here. Oh, I'm going to read Lynn's comment about the caterpillars because I don't know anything about them. She said, not the caterpillars, sorry, they start off as caterpillars, but the moths. Remember I said we have lots of moths right now. She says, they lay their eggs underground and hatch out into caterpillars and then turn into moths in the spring. They are kind of early, and some of the birds who usually get here to eat them haven't arrived yet. So we do have a moth season when the moths have already metamorphosized into moths and the birds who eat them have not yet arrived. So that's the story there. Okay. I'm going to read number 164 in the book, and then we'll go to the journal. So here's what the quote is in the Seven Steps to Awakening. An imaginary object is imaginatively described by someone, and one understands in one's own imagination and imagines that he understands it. All right, I'm going to read this one again. An imaginary object is imaginatively described by someone, and one understands in one's own imagination and imagines that he understands it. All right, let's look at number 164 in the journal. Truth cannot be reached through mind, but mind doesn't know this, so it reaches. It listens to descriptions of truth and grasps for mental understanding so it can say, I know. From this belief desire of knowing, it climbs into the imagination and describes imagined truth for others. Their grasping minds imagine likewise and agree, I know. In this way, imagined knowing spreads like a virus. This is why time alone has been called for. In quarantine, the virus is contained. In the medicine of self, it is hushed. In the silence of hush, it dies. When this virus is removed, one is again on the open path of awakening. I remember talking about this weekend also in Quincy. Again, this is my journal, so I perceive this as my guidance. If anybody else wants to perceive it as theirs, that is up to you. But if you also feel like, you know what, this isn't for me, I'm totally okay with that because I would agree. This is self talking to self. But last year, I spent more time than I ever have before being outer focused in my learning. I mean, if you know me, most of the learning has come from within. The messages, NTI, Inner Ramana. It's been a very within process. But last year, I started reading Jan Fraser. I also read A Thousand Names for Joy by Byron Katie. I read Robert Adams. I read David Kars. I read at least half, maybe three quarters of Rupert Spira. I listened to Muji a lot. And there may be somebody I'm leaving out. I don't know for sure. But I was very focused outwardly on teachers. And some of these teachers describe the experience of enlightenment. I think another one was Lisa Carnes, right? Laurent's girlfriend. Oh, Bentino. Right? There were others. There were quite a few. And what happened for me, and maybe not just me, is that the mind was listening to them. Not just the mind, the heart also listened, by the way. So when the heart listens, the heart hears differently. The heart takes what is really useful for one's own awakening, truly. And there were things that the heart took, and I'm very aware of what the heart took. Those things feel solid. But the mind was also reaching. And the mind was trying to imagine the experience of awakening or enlightenment. And what I can see now is that if that had been allowed to continue, it was cut short by guidance, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But if that had been allowed to continue, there's a distinct possibility that the mind would have gone into a false enlightenment. You know, let's look again at what the Supreme Yoga is saying. An imaginary object is imaginatively described by someone, and one understands in one's own imagination and imagines that he understands it. And now let's look at what 164 in the journal says. Truth cannot be reached through mind, but mind doesn't know this, so it reaches. So, you know, simultaneously you could say, while we are on this spiritual path and we're reading whatever we're reading and listening to whatever we're listening to, our heart is there pointing out for us what is helpful for us. But our mind is there too. And our mind is also reaching for it, trying to be that, trying to get there. So it can be as if something healthy and unhealthy is happening simultaneously. You know, the split mind. So truth cannot be reached through mind, but mind doesn't know this, so it reaches. It listens to descriptions of truth and grasps for mental understanding so it can say, I know. It wants so bad to have that same experience, right? The mind wants to be enlightened. So it stretches trying to see the way the speaker says that it sees. From this belief desire of knowing, once it grasps and it believes it knows, it then climbs into the imagination unknowingly and describes imagined truth for others. This is how I see it, says. And their grasping minds imagine likewise. The same process continues. And they agree, I know. And in this way, imagined knowing spreads like a virus. And we know that we have maximum opportunity for this virus to spread now. I mean, look at everything that we have, all of the books that we have, all of the teachers that we have, Facebook, email, YouTube, you know, I'm sure, you know, more than that. There is so much opportunity for this virus to spread, for this mind to listen to enlightenment described and then try and reach for it and then believe that it's there. And notice again what my guidance says. This is why time alone has been called for. If you know me, you know that this year I am not reading any books other than the Seven Steps and then A Course in Miracles because of my Community Miracle Center ordination program and NTI because I teach it on Tuesdays. But I'm not reading any books. People have recommended books to me this year. My guidance has been consistently no. People have given me books. My guidance has been, you know, put them down. You know, say thank you and put them down. I'm not reading books this year. I'm going back to the process of within. And there's a very strong feeling here that this is, I'm going to call it, purely authentic. Where not that there wasn't any authentic in the listening, because like I said, the heart was listening too. But the mind was there, so it wasn't purely authentic. There were two things going on there. And when I'm focused within, it's purely authentic. There's only one thing going on there, for me anyway. There's only heart. So this is why time alone has been called for. In quarantine, the virus is contained. So whatever damage has already been done is then contained. In the medicine of self, that inner listening, it is hushed because the self actually is much more solid. I used the word solid before. It's much more solid. And so the shakiness of the imagined ideas that mind came up with, they don't stand up against the solidity of what self knows. And so, you know, just by comparison, those mind ideas just kind of fall away. In the silence of hush, it dies. When the virus is removed, one is again on the open path of awakening. So again, as I said, this is my guidance. This does not mean that necessarily that everyone else should should stop listening to teachings. I mean, that's up to you. I'm not saying you should. I'm not saying you shouldn't. I just have no opinion on your guidance. But my guidance is right now to be in a place of within only, and that is what I'm doing. So let's scroll down, and we'll go to number 165. Scroll down on the left. And I think there might be new people in the room, so I will also post this link in the room. And then once again, this is a wonderful opportunity for me to take a drink of water, so I will. Oh yeah, hi Jay, I saw you pop in the room. I'm always happy to see you, of course. All right, so I'm going to read number 165 from The Seven Steps to Awakening, and it says, abandoning mental conditioning, be a liberated soul. It's quite simple. Oh, wait, Deb has her hand up. Yep, Deb, I just now saw your hand. I will turn the mic over to you.
Thanks, Regina. I just got here and Lynn said that you had another 30 minutes and I didn't know if it was interactive or not, but I had some like really, what feels to be like really major guidance or something, and it started last night, and I'm sure as I was listening to you, and as I always, you know, every time I listen to you, I feel like that it would be totally related. And see, I'm kind of excited about it because what you're talking about is guidance. Hang on a minute. Uh, Okay, and inner guidance. And oh boy, okay. Let me drop the mic. I'm not sure. I'm dropping the mics. Sorry.
That's okay, Deb. And actually, I think after me also, there's a half hour with nothing scheduled. I stop at 11:30 my time, which I believe is 12:30 your time, in half an hour. And then, oh, Lynn's on then. Okay, well then I believe Dove was mistaken. He had told me there was no one I could go 2 hours. I said I didn't want to. So Deb, if you get your thoughts back and you do feel that it's related, you can take the mic. We do try very much to stay on topic though. One thing that's important for me is that I do believe the seven steps have a clear, consistent message if we follow quote to quote to quote that is being taught. And of course, if we interrupt that and go off into another discussion, then that gets lost. And to me, what's being communicated by the seven steps is just too precious. So it is interactive, but it needs to be on topic. So really, anything that's said should be directly related to what we were just talking about, which just now was really the virus of false enlightenment spreading and the guidance to spend time, you know, in quarantine or alone, or questions related to that. And I see Jay has his hand up, so I'm turning the mic over to Jay. Hi, Jay. I see your hand up, but I don't see you taking the mic. I'm not sure if you're locked up, what's going on. But I will let go for a second and see if you take the mic. If you don't, then I'll assume maybe it's a lockup. And I'll continue. Here you go, Jay. All right. I see you typed the word bad. I don't know what that means. Maybe it means you're locked up bad. I don't know. Yeah, now your hand's down. So what I'm going to do then is just continue. So we were getting ready for number 165. I had just read it once, but since we kind of, you know, went around a little bit, let's go back and I'll read 165 again, and then we'll get into the journal. Abandoning mental conditioning, be a liberated soul. That's the quote. It's very short. Abandoning mental conditioning, be a liberated soul. All right, let's look at number 165 in the journal. And I think it's even possible that people have entered the room since I posted this. So I'm going to go ahead and post this link again. And here's what 165 says. Oh, yeah, this is another good one. another good one for all of us to look at. How do I like things to be? How do I not like things to be? What do I want? What do I wish would change? Find every answer to these questions, and then realize that every answer given is part of the prison I keep myself in. Letting go of these ideas is like taking down the prison walls stone by stone. When no answer to these questions arises in me, there is also no prison. Now again, the quote from the Seven Steps to Awakening said, abandoning mental conditioning, be a liberated soul. Abandoning mental conditioning, be a liberated soul. But of course, we aren't... you know, we can talk about abandoning, you know, our conditioning, but we aren't typically really even aware of what that conditioning is. It kind of runs in the background, like a background virus. So these questions are actually designed by my inner self to help me notice and recognize conditioning that I may not have noticed and recognized before. How do I like things to be? Some of you may have heard me talk, you know, in the last month or so about one thing I discovered was I liked the glasses put away a certain way in the cabinets. Right? That's just one small example of conditioning. And, you know, it was enough that when I opened the cabinets and the glasses had been put away differently, I would rearrange them. You know, it's in order to, if I had to rearrange them, that must mean, although there was no big upset here, there must have been enough of an uncomfortableness with the glasses not in order that they had to be put in order, right? But through questioning like this, I came to see that, even though I've been doing it for, you know, a couple years, I came to see it. I actually realized how ridiculous it was. I also saw at the same time, again, the split mind. I did see the little part of the mind that said, no, the glasses need to be this way. I saw that. But I chose to say, no, they don't. I chose to stay with the part of the mind that said, no, this is silly. They don't have to be that way. And I even went against that conditioning directly by starting to just put the cabinet, the glasses away in the cabinet anyway. You know, just anyway. Like, so now they're all mixed up. They're not in sets anymore. You know, because, again, if we abandon our mental conditioning, and although that was a small thing, that was a mental conditioning, if we abandon our mental conditioning, we are a liberated soul. I no longer have to open the cabinets and wish the glasses were in a certain way. That's gone. So these questions are designed by my inner self to help me see where conditioning is still operating. It's easy to see, well, at least it is for me, it's easy to see where conditioning is operating if there's some kind of a big upset. In fact, in my case, big upsets don't really tend to happen anymore. But sometimes when the upset is just this minor little uncomfortableness, it goes unnoticed. But these questions help to bring even that up. How do I like things to be? You know, look around your house. How do you like things to be? Look at your spouse or your partner. How do you like that person to be? Look at your children. How do you want them to be? Look at your body. How do you like it to be? You know, look around. You'll find answers. How do I not like things to be? Look at your house. How do you not like it? Your spouse or partner, your children, your body. What do you want? What do you wish would change? It says, find every answer to these questions and then realize that every answer given is a part of the prison I keep myself in. Letting go of these ideas is like taking down the prison walls stone by stone. When no answer to these questions arises in me, when I can, there's no certain way that I want my house or don't want my house or want my partner or don't want my partner or want my body or don't want my body or want my daughter or don't want my daughter. When there is true contentment with whatever is, then there is no prison because there is nothing that can upset the true contentment, right? Nothing can become out of whack, in my opinion, according to my conditioning. Everything is perfect as it is. So, again, how do I like things to be? How do I not like things to be? What do I want? What do I wish would change? Find every answer to these questions and then realize that every answer given is part of the prison I keep myself in. Letting go of these ideas is like taking down the prison walls stone by stone. When no answer to these questions arises in me, there is also no prison. That's freedom. All right, so let's scroll down And on the left, underneath the reply area, you'll see the little number 166. That's what you want to click on, and I will give the link in the room as well. And I'm going to read first from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, page 40, number 167. Remain forever established in that state of utter freedom from movement of thought. Again, remain forever established in that state of utter freedom from movement of thought. All right. So I said I was going to give you one. Did I read the wrong one? The numbering is changed. I'm a little confused. Nope, I skipped one. That's what happened. I just read the wrong one. Okay, now I'm unconfused. I read 167 and we're supposed to be on 166. So let me go back and read the correct quote. Are you ready? Erase your mind from the previous quote, at least for now. 166. Ignorance and mental activity are perpetuated by each other. This is the correct quote. Ignorance and mental activity are perpetuated by each other. Okay, now let's look at number 166 in the journal. What makes the illusion continue? Thinking, mind wandering, daydreaming. This is what illusion is made of. Therefore, if one wishes to let go of illusion, one must also be willing to let go of thinking about illusion, even as illusion sparks and ignites thinking. The choice to not think must be valued more than the thought to solve the illusion puzzle. The choice to not think must be valued more than the thought to solve the illusion puzzle. I'm not going to say that I don't still think, mind wander, or daydream, because I do. But this year, along with the Seven Steps work, this is something I have been significantly watching. And what I mean by that is that when the mind goes off into a daydream or thinking about something, there's a noticing of that, and then there's a pulling back. So it stops, it doesn't continue. And as a result of that practice, it might be even lessening. I can't say that for a fact, so that's why I say might. But there's something that I've noticed about myself recently, which might be because there's not as much thinking happening. I've noticed that when I get with my friends, it doesn't matter if I'm getting with my friends in person or in email, you know, somebody writes to catch up. What I've noticed is, you know, they'll tell me, you know, what's going on with them, their stories, and I don't have a story to tell back. I mean, nothing. It's a little bit of a strange feeling, actually, because there's still, I guess, this little thought in the mind that I should share with them too. But there's, you know, there's just this nothing. It's like, gosh, well, what have I been doing? You know, and the honest feeling is, you know, just living. I mean, I've just been living. I've just been doing what's right in front of me. And it's not that my life has changed so much in form. It's, I think that what has happened is that the mind interpretation and storytelling within my own mind about what's happening has slowed down. And as a result, those stories aren't developed and ready to share. The way I said it to my friend Lisa Hansen this weekend when I saw her for the first time in months is I just said, you know, I was with her and I think my other friend Paula, both very dear friends. And I think I just said something like, I'm sorry, but my mind just doesn't think in stories anymore. I don't really have anything to share. And that's true. At least to some degree. I don't have a story to tell. And I know I've been doing stuff. I'm busy. I know that I'm, you know, the body's moving around. I'm doing stuff with Jasmine. I'm doing stuff with Danielle. You know, there are things that come before me that kind of need to be worked out, and they're getting worked out. But for some reason, the mind isn't holding on to those things in a story form like it used to where they can be called up into memory and shared with friends. So if that's true, if that's true, then there's an assumption here that there just must not be as much story making going on. That is finally starting to reduce. So again, number 166 says, what makes the illusion continue? Thinking, mind wandering, daydreaming. This is what illusion is made of. Therefore, if one wishes to let go of illusion, one must also be willing to let go of thinking about illusion, even as illusion sparks and ignites thinking. Now, this last sentence to me is important. The choice to not think must be valued more than the thought to solve the illusion puzzle. This is the practice I talked about where I said when the mind would go off into thinking, I would pull it back. In other words, it would stop short before the mind got to what it could call a solution or a conclusion to what it was working on. I would just, in the noticing that that was happening, I would just stop it, just pull it back. I will be honest. I didn't find this difficult. I don't know if that means anything, because sometimes when I talk to people, they say, well, I can't do that. And I don't know if that's true or not. I don't want to speak about anyone else's experience. I don't know if that has to do with a phase, you could say, that I'm at because of other work that's previously been done where I can just say, oh, there goes the mind thinking again, and I don't want that, and I can just stop it. Or maybe it has more to do with attachment. Maybe if I was really attached to whatever the mind was thinking about, and maybe it also has to do with belief. If I really believed I had to solve this problem, then I wouldn't be able to stop it. There'd be too much panic about the idea of stopping this thought process. But maybe for me it's just that there's enough knowing already that I don't have to solve this problem, that all things solve themselves. And maybe there's enough desire to drop it that it's easy, but it is easy. The only thing that occurs for me is I have to notice. The waking up has to happen, because whenever the thinking starts to occur or the daydreaming starts to occur, that's always happening in a period of non-alertness, right? I'm not paying attention. So the awakening to that, the seeing, look what I'm doing, has to happen. And I don't know what makes that happen. I suppose using Course in Miracles language, we'd say Holy Spirit. It's a miracle that I notice I'm not alert. That has to be a miracle, right? I mean, how could non-alertness know that it's non-alert? It has to be a miracle that steps in and makes me aware. But then once that awareness comes, it is easy for me to remember, oh, I don't want this. And so I pull back from it. I'll just read it one more time. I think we're done with this one. What makes the illusion continue? Thinking, mind wandering, daydreaming. This is what illusion is made of. Therefore, if one wishes to let go of illusion, one must also be willing to let go of thinking about illusion, even as illusion sparks and ignites thinking. The choice to not think must be valued more. Maybe that's why it's somewhat easy for me, because the choice to not think is now valued more, right? The choice to not think must be valued more than the thought to solve the illusion puzzle. All right, let's scroll down and click on number 167. And this is the quote I read a while ago when I didn't need to. So now we'll get to read it again. Number 167. Remain forever established in that state of utter freedom from movement of thought. Okay, so this is the one we already read. Remain forever established in that state of utter freedom from movement of thought. So now we'll go to the journal. And this is a very wonderful follow-up to the last one. Are you ready? Can I not think? The better question is, who am I? Am I the thinking character caught up in the thinking of illusion? Or am I that which precedes mind? If I am that which precedes mind, can I be myself even as the noise of mind continues? Do not focus on stopping thinking. The one concerned with thinking cannot stop it. Instead, notice where attention is directed. Remember that attention focus on mind identifies one as mind, but attention focus on self realizes self. Now maybe this is another reason why what I call stopping thinking or pulling back from thinking seems easy for me, and some people claim that it's difficult or impossible for them. Maybe it's an understanding of what those words mean. Again, I learned this from within. So when I learn from within, there's a very clear understanding of what's being learned. But if someone else teaches it with words, my mind, remember, is a part of that listening process. And my mind is interpreting what they mean. My mind may even be interpreting it, you know, with a bit of difference, putting that person on a pedestal. I'm not as good. I'm not as far along, whatever. So it's not a pure interpretation by any stretch of the imagination. And so I hear the same words, but I have a different understanding what that means, and therefore the practice that I'm trying is actually an entirely different practice. Although I say that I can just stop the thinking or I can just pull back from the thinking, notice I also say that that's easy for me. Which means, I think, you know, based on what others are sharing with me, which means I'm not actually trying to stop the thinking the way some people hear it. What I'm doing is shifting my attention. And then I guess the thinking just kind of stops on its own. It's not like I have my attention on the thinking. I'm not staring at the thinking, judging the thinking, and trying to stop the thinking. What I really do is I remove my attention from the thinking. That's what I mean when I say I stop the thinking. And maybe what some people are still doing is staying very focused on the thinking in some way, along with focused on judgment of themselves about the thinking, and they're trying to make it stop, and they can't. But the attention has actually been enhanced in the direction of thinking, rather than being removed from thinking. If we use the example of the split mind that's given to us in A Course in Miracles, you know, the Course in Miracles talks about the wrong mind and the right mind. What really needs to happen is a shift from the wrong mind to the right mind. I cannot stay in the wrong mind and stop the thinking. Or the way it's worded here is, I cannot be the thinking character caught up in the thinking and stop it. A shift has to occur. That's the only way it can happen, is a shift. How does that shift occur? Well, there's a few possible ways, actually. One is, I can ask myself, what do I really want? It's more related to quote number 166. What do I really want? Do I want to value trying to solve this problem? Or do I want to value letting go of this and knowing peace, knowing myself, awakening? Which do I want more? And by asking that investigative question, I realize that I want more to let go of this. So through that realization, a shift occurs. I shift out of the wrong mind. Another way to shift is being recommended in number 167. Who am I? Who am I? Am I this person? This, for me, I can't ask the next question because it's wordless. Am I this person? Or am I this? You know, I know what this is, but am I this? Which is non-affected by everything, which is perfectly okay always. And when I ask that question, there's a knowing in the heart that I'm this, which is unaffected by, so I don't need to solve this problem. I don't need to try and control or change anything. But see, if I keep thinking, no, I'm this person, and I have this lack, or I have these needs in order to be happy, you know, I'm this person, and I need this to be this way a certain time. If I stay in that wrong mind, I'm not going to be able to stop the thinking. I have to shift out of that. So when people say to me, I can't do that, it's difficult, I can't stop the thinking, again, I'm not in their experience, so I don't know what's going on, but it's extremely possible that they haven't caught on to the idea of the shift. And they haven't found the inquiry within them that will allow them to make the shift. So they're actually staying fully attached to everything that's in the wrong mind and then trying to stop it too, and that can't be done. It can't be done from within the wrong mind. The shift to the right mind needs to occur. And then, as I mentioned, at least in my experience, once that shift occurs, it's actually easy. It's not difficult. So, can I not think? The better question is, who am I? Am I the thinking character caught up in the thinking of illusion? Or am I that which precedes mind? If I am that which precedes mind, can I be myself even as the noise of mind continues? Can I just shift over there? Do not focus on stopping thinking. The one concerned with thinking cannot stop it. You can't stay in the wrong mind and make that happen. Instead, notice where attention is directed. Remember that attention, focus on mind, identifies one as mind, or using the language of A Course in Miracles, we could say attention, focus on wrong mind, identifies one as wrong mind. But attention, focus on self, realizes self. Or attention, focus on right mind, realizes right mind. So it's all about the shift. So for those of you who have always heard me talking about stopping thinking, and you did not understand the shift, if I wasn't clear on that, realize that may be why it seems difficult for you, because the shift is the missing part of the answer. Maybe you're staying in the full attachment to the wrong mind and trying to make it stop. Be worried. You're trying to be worried and stop the talk about the worry too. And that's not going to work. So instead of focusing on stopping the thinking in your case, start focusing on how can I make the shift? What question, what realization, what understanding, what remembrance will help me make the shift? Focus on the shift. And then the letting go of the thinking should not be difficult. All right, we have just 3 minutes left. I don't know what number 168 looks like. Let me peek at it. Well, we'll see. I'll go ahead and give you a link to number 168. We'll see if we can do this in 3 minutes. If not, then that's okay too. All right, so number 168 in the book. I can't say this name, so get ready for me to totally ruin an Indian name. Bhagaratha, or maybe I did it right, who knows? Bhagaratha asked, I know that the self alone is real, and the body, etc., are not real. But how is it that it is not perfectly clear to me? Tritala answered, such intellectual knowledge is not knowledge. So again, Bhagaratha is saying, I know this, but it's not clear. And Tritala is pointing out that's because it's only intellectual knowledge, and intellectual knowledge is not knowledge. All right, so let's look at number 168 in the journal. If I think I know a spiritual truth, but I can become confused on that point or sometimes forget what I know, then I do not know it. Do not let the mind delude me into believing I know what I do not know. What is known is directly experienced always. So yeah, absolutely, the thinking mind believes that having learned it in a book, being able to recite it back to others means that you know it. But if it's not automatically lived, or automatically present, automatically being in your experience always, then it is not known. You know, so an example would be like You had a child that was constantly interrupting people. And you said to the child, you know, Julie, it's not polite to interrupt. And she goes, I know. And then she goes right on doing it. She doesn't know. She doesn't know. She's heard it before. But she doesn't know. Well, you know, you practice. If you know, something in you knows that it's better to let someone else finish. If you really know that you need to be listening instead of speaking, listening instead of thinking, then that's what you're doing. Maybe that's a silly example, but it's the one that came to mind. So it's the living it. When you are living it, being it, when it is always present, then it is knowledge. And if it can be forgotten or if you can be confused on that point, you do not know it, so do not let the mind tell you that you do. All right? All right, that's it for me today. You guys have a wonderful day, and thank you for coming. Oh, Lisa says it's a great example. Okay, thanks, Lisa. All right, bye.